What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am, of course, your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Adam Curry. Adam Curry is a lot of things. He is a podcaster, announcer, internet entrepreneur, and media personality. Adam became known as the Podfather because he was the first one to publish a podcast, The Daily Source Code, on the internet after he worked with Dave Weiner to create the podcast specification, which later became known as the iTunes podcast specification, which was itself based on RSS. In 1987, Kurt became a VJ for MTV. Besides making spot appearances between music videos, he was also host of the programs Headbangers Ball and MTV Top 20 Video Countdown. Since October 2007, he has hosted the twice-weekly podcast The No Agenda Show with John C. Dvorak, discussing recent news whilst deconstructing mainstream news media. I had him on for about an hour. We talked about a lot. He's lived a pretty incredible life, many touch points with history, which obviously we get into. And now I give you the Podfather, Adam Curry. Okay, I'm here with Adam Curry. Adam, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's good to be here, man. I'm very excited about this. I finally get to get a do-over on my Wikipedia page. Those who don't know what I'm talking about, way back in the beginning of podcasting, there was a wiki. Today is a huge Wikipedia page about podcasting, and everybody invented podcasting. Everybody except Dave Wine and Adam Curry, pretty much. And there's all these nuances. And I was like, hey, this is not how I remember it. Let me just change this. And I didn't know that you're not allowed to change or to add to history that you are a part of. And so here's a podcast where you're talking to the people who were part of history. Oh, nice. I get to tell the story. That's great. I love that. I love that you're doing this.
Yeah, no, excellent. No, I appreciate some of that background. I'm excited to chat with you for many reasons. You kind of gleaned at it just there, Adam. There's other stuff that I want to track through as well. Before we get there, please tell our listeners just briefly sort of who you are and what you do.
Well, I've always been in broadcasting pretty much since I can remember. I've been playing around with recording equipment, with reel-to-reels and microphones. But around 14, I built my first transmitter, and I built a little studio, a music studio to kind of go with it to play more than, you know, to be able to mix one record to the next. And so I really got into radio early on. In fact, I did a lot of pirate radio. And then growing up in the Netherlands, did legit radio. And then by almost a fluke, got into television. I was doing a big music-based show in the Netherlands when I was 19. And then 3 or 4 years later, MTV called me. When MTV still played music, we can certainly talk about that. And they invited me to come to New York. And I did. And I wound up staying at MTV for 7 years, doing a lot of radio things in the meantime, and then went into business, and I took a company public on NASDAQ, kind of in 1996, before the big dot-com craze. But, you know, I'd seen that the internet was the place. In fact, I left MTV because I knew the internet would be the place to broadcast, or, you know, how we would transfer information of the future, and did okay with that. And then I grew up in Amsterdam, so went back to the Netherlands just around 2000. And then a couple of years later, through a number of, really interesting circumstances, came up with the concept for podcasting and worked with Dave Weiner. And before it was even had a name, we didn't come up with a name, and it just took off and it worked. And then that was also because of the iPod, the technology we had already created in 2000, the whole idea. But then when the iPod came around, it all kind of clicked. And, you know, it was a hot commodity early on. A lot of public broadcasters liked it, like NPR and the BBC. And so they did a lot of stories about it. And it did quite well until, I'd say, around 2008. And that's when YouTube was purchased for $1 billion. And Twitter came on the scene, and Facebook. You know, you could get on Facebook without a school email address. And podcasting got snowed under. It just, like, it was It was from page one to page 13 below the fold, maybe a little story. But it grew very, very slowly, quietly, because it's completely decentralized. Not one company owns it. Mm-hmm. And it just kept on growing with really small hosting companies, a couple of big apps, and notably Apple, the Apple podcast app, which has really launched to it really launched podcasting into mainstream until 2016, when Serial came along at the height of yet another innovation, which was streaming. Oh, we have Hulu, we have Netflix. We're binging our ass off. We're watching all five seasons of Breaking Bad. Our eyes are like this Monday morning at school or at the workplace. And here along came this really compelling story without any pictures, just a story. True crime is certainly in the United States, we're obsessed with it. We love true crime drama. You know, it's such a great category, particularly when done the way Serial did it. And that was very specific. You cannot binge it. You have to wait until next week to find out what happens. So yeah, you could catch up and binge up until the point where everyone else was. So it became water cooler talk. It became, you know, something that people really enjoyed, and they kind of loved having this waiting moment and guessing and you know, talking about it. And that was just such a beautiful thing. And that relaunched podcasting in general brought it back under everybody's eye. And at the same time, you know, other companies foolishly thought they could monetize on it. We can get into that. Mm-hmm. And then you got big name contracts and companies getting bought out. And, you know, so podcasting just expanded. Everyone has a podcast. You know, you have to have a podcast. It's not even dorky to have a podcast anymore. Now, of course, pendulum has swung. If you're a podcast, you're probably also a day trader and you're probably scum. So there's a lot of this happened along the way. And in fact, just to solidify that it remains the independent, decentralized, widely distributed mechanism that it is. 3 years ago, I started podcastindex.org to make sure that no one can be deplatformed. We put some, mechanisms in there so you can actually be financed without being, you know, financially deplatformed. So if you want people to support your show. So we built that, and we now have over 70 apps and services using the index. It's completely free for anyone to use. And that's, you know, and I'm working with people like you, your age, you know, the millennials, I would say, my daughter's age too. Yes. I love it because, you know, it's such an interesting group who went through quite a lot. And a lot of the crap you've gone through is my generation's fault because, like, school board, lots of losers get on school boards, you know, the city council. Oh, please, you have anything better to do? Oh, you're partying in the 80s and 90s, making money, doing great. But, you know, you got screwed by a lot of things, and financially, certainly all the way up to COVID, you know, coming out looking for jobs out of college. My degree may not be worth as much as they promised me, certainly not how much I borrowed for to get it. And, you know, then we go through another financial crisis and COVID. And I think everyone is kind of, you know, out there going, hey, what is there? What can I do? And the two things that excite me are podcasting and Bitcoin, specifically not crypto, but Bitcoin, and how the millennial group is using this to build alternative networks of schooling, transactions, and communications. And it's everything but Silicon Valley, really. So, and that's who I am today and what I'm enjoying doing besides my own podcast.
That's wonderful, Adam. No, thank you for taking a minute on that. I appreciate it. I love when I can move forward with the table, you know, set. Makes it an easy day. Winding the clock back, Adam, try to trigger some nostalgia for you. What was Radio Picasso?
Yeah. Oh, you did dive deep.
Probably the best.
So growing up in the Netherlands, and we moved there in 72. I was born in D.C., Arlington Hospital, and we moved around, you know, everyone in that area is some government worker somehow. So we actually lived in Uganda for a little bit when I was very young, back to Maryland, and then to the Netherlands in 72. A very different media landscape. They literally had two television stations. They come on at 7 p.m., go off air at 11. They had four radio stations, one talk, one classical, one was, I'm not sure what that third one, maybe religious. And then you had one which was the station three, a very, very imaginative Netherlands three, or radio three, I think they called it at a certain point. And it started at 7 a.m., went off the air at 11 p.m., and they played popular music, which at the time was kind of like Lawrence Welk polka music, you know. So this was not at all reflective of what we even getting on, you know, records. You could get better stuff on records. And because of this, and it's all government controlled, kind of the same way the BBC controlled everything. France has their media under control. It's become much more commercial now. But there's the pirate radio ships in the North Sea, Mi Amigo, Radio Caroline, Radio Veronica, all of these. And it would just be, there would be an international waters broadcasting on medium wave or, so AM or medium wave. And people would listen to that on their radios on shore, and you would hear all kinds of music that, certainly U.S. influences that you couldn't even hear on your own terrestrial radio stations. So by the time I'm 14, 15, I've already built my first transmitter, and I get together with a group of guys, and we set up a radio station that only operates on Sunday, and it's called Radio Picasso. I don't know why we called it that. It's, kind of goofy now that I think about it. My name was John Holden. You had to have an alias because, otherwise, if the FCC was looking for you, they could get you easily if you gave your real name. And we would do a radio show. We put up an antenna on Sunday morning early, and then we start doing shows, and we had, linear programming. So like everyone had 2 hours, I think, and took it all the way through Sunday night. And we had listeners and people who were fans, and they would send in postcards. I think at one point we had a number you could call in live, which by itself was also risky. And I think I was 16 when we started that with a couple of our guys, and it was fun. We didn't really have any ads or anything. We're just kind of doing it just for doing it. And it was a really good time. That was Radio Picasso. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome, Adam. I'm really curious about, certainly about your time at MTV, which I want to get to in a second, but I'm also curious about how you transitioned over to MTV. Because I would imagine, of course, I'd love for you to go into it. I would imagine it's not quite as simple as going to MTV and saying, "Hey, I have all this illegal radio in my backlog and experience." Or is it that simple?
Well, it was actually even simpler. But what happened was I was doing all this radio pirate stuff, and I was doing it in English. And I wound up at a station on Saturday nights who only broadcast on the weekends. Radio Decibel in Amsterdam. Now, this was big. We had hundreds of thousands of people listening. And again, the radio station, the official stations are playing Hoompa music, Hoompa Pa, and we're getting, Chicago warehouse tracks. We have a whole pipeline from the U.S., 12 inches. We're playing, everything from the BB&Q band to anything that Frankie Knuckles might have mixed to early Fun Boy 3 Bananarama. The whole Blitz movement, like Human League and Away, we're talking 80, 81. So really, really, really early on. And I decided that, well, I didn't decide. My parents decided that everyone had to go to college. And so they said, well, you need to go to higher education. And I decided I would go to the States and I would find a college that would let me on the radio station as a freshman. And I wanted to study communications. And pretty much the only school that I could find was in Salem, West Virginia. Of all places.
Culture shock.
Oh man, that was the problem. I mean, it was great being there, and I was on the air almost immediately. I was running the station within, 6 weeks, but it was like, I grew up in Amsterdam, so you could get a beer if you were 13 and look 15. Smoking weed was really no big deal because it was, for all intents and purposes, legal. And here were just people like, how much can I smoke? How much can I drink? How much fast can I drive? I'm like, So it was, I could not, I was like, this is not for me. I got other things to do with my life. And so my parents said, great. And so I'm 19. They didn't like it that I dropped out. They said, actually, you either, within a month, you either go back to another school, you have a job, you're paying us rent, or you're out. And I'm like, oh, what am I going to do? And so I just sent off some letters to people, including at this point, one of the pirate radio stations, Radio Veronica. They had become legit. And so they had shared airtime on the official airwaves run by the government. So they had, it's a very weird system. And it was really organized by religion early on, it was like the Protestants, the evangelicals, the Roman Catholics, they all had their own little groups. And how that worked is a whole nother, that's an interesting history, if you want to do history of media in Europe. But they had enough members. That's how you get airtime. So they had Friday on the popular radio station, but they also had television time and they didn't know what to do with it. So they'd started this show called Countdown, and it was pretty new, and they had a host and a Dutch guy. And, the Netherlands at the time was kind of the gateway to Europe for everything. So where the, you know, if you wanted to launch your record, you came through the Netherlands and that's where you did your first tour. And so we had everyone coming through, the Rolling Stones, Diana Ross at the time, Tina Turner, David Bowie, you know, you name it, all the really big, big, big names, Michael Jackson, all of them coming through the European gateway. And so I got a call from Lex Harding, the guy who, you know, was in charge of Radio Veronica and helped bring it legally into the system. And he said, I saw your note and I want to talk to you. So come on by. And I was like, oh, this is cool. This is like 3 weeks into my ultimatum. I'm like, oh, maybe I'll get a gig. I was ready to work in the mailroom, whatever. And he said, you know, I've heard some of your stuff. And I also sent him a video cassette of me just horsing around in our studio. What I don't really remember. It was dumb, walking over cars, doing fake interviews with my friends. And he said, well, we want, you know, the host is leaving. We want you to do a countdown this Sunday, which was literally like 5 days away. And it's live and it's for half the country. And Talk will be on. And who else? Who else was on that first one? I think Ultravox. And you'll be interviewing them. And, you know, it starts at 7. And no matter what happens to you, it'll end at 7:55. That's when we hit the news break and that'll be done. And so welcome aboard. I was like, holy crap. And I'm an audio guy. I've never any intention to do television. I did like the live aspect. I could get so pumped up, and you know, that's just like a live radio show. Like I love the live aspect. Like I can get into that anytime. And I did, and it went very well for 3-4 years. And literally out of the blue, well, a lot was happening because then we spun off. There was a European satellite consortium of all European public broadcasters called Europa TV. And so this is when, you know, satellite television and cable was rolling out all across Europe. And we delivered one day of music television every day on that station. So all of a sudden I was in Scandinavia, in Portugal, in Spain, and all over Europe. So it was kind of cool to do that. And MTV saw me. I'm not sure exactly who or how, but they called me and said, would you like to come and work for us in New York? I'm like, yeah, sure. Why not? And that was 86, and went out. And in 87, I was on the air. And it was, so to get back to your original question, it was really weird because I came from doing television in the public system, which had so much money. We had 12 cameras. We had 3 makeup artists. You know, we had the, you know, lighting engineers who were working on lighting and set design, you know, 3 days before the broadcast. MTV was like, here's your spot. Boom, boom. That's your light. Don't move from that. Put your microphone on. There's your teleprompter. Let's go. And when you come on, chop, chop. If we didn't have the videos there, we just do the breaks in between the videos. We wouldn't actually see those. So we'd be looking away like, wow, I love that Whitesnake, man. That's one of my favorite videos. Coming up next, we got Guns N' Roses. Oh, in fact, here they are. And you look over there, pretend you're looking at the video starting. Of course, that was it. And that would get sent later. They would actually take it in. This is before we had technology. They would take it in a car, drive it to Long Island. And it's like, these were U-matic, so kind of like high-end Betamax tapes. And there would literally be, you have these guys who would be sitting there and they'd play a video. And as the video was ending, they'd hit, you know, my break where I'd say that was Whitesnake. And they'd be ready, and then now over to Guns N' Roses, they hit the next video. So they only had just those outtakes of all the BJs. Of course, we did do some live stuff, but yeah. So that was the transition, and it was mind bending because I went from a very, you know, well oiled, highly trained machine of, you know, a crew of 30, 35 to 2 camera people, Warren and Celeste, the audio guy Rick, you know, and we had rotating directors and producers. And no wardrobe, no makeup.
Wow.
I'm so old. We used blue screen before we started to use green screen. That's what we had. So it was really weird because it was a low budget operation. It was really low budget, but it was Manhattan. It was phenomenal to be living in Hell's Kitchen, which, you know, really truly was Hell's Kitchen in 1987. Was a great time. I'm so happy that I experienced all that.
Yeah, absolutely, Adam. Thank you. I wouldn't mind taking a few minutes on MTV if we may. Yeah, I want to talk about a few of the interviews that you did. The first one, I suspect you'll even know which one I'm going to refer to, was when you interviewed, not interviewed, but you introduced actually Tom Freston.
Michael Jackson. Yeah.
There, I knew you were going to say who. Yeah. And he awarded Michael Jackson the Vanguard Award. I know there's an interesting backstory to why he was awarded the award, but I'd love to ask you if you can recall that experience, what that experience was like. And then also, I know there's a interesting thing that I've seen you pull in regarding dishonesty in that medium.
Yes.
Would you want to string all that together for me?
Yeah, yeah. You've done your homework well.
Oh,
yeah. So Michael Jackson, a deal, television is all about deals. And so Michael Jackson had a deal with MTV. He would perform on the Video Music Awards, which is a big deal for MTV. It was our big annual 4.0 rating show. That was huge. You get a lot of people watch. 5 million people watch. That was crazy for MTV. But in return, and I'm not sure if he asked or we offered, but he was going to have an award named after him, which would be the Michael Jackson Video Vanguard Award of the Year, which I think now has just become the Video Vanguard Award of the Year. It's like he's dead. It's like, we can drop the Michael Jackson part. But it was supposed to be the Michael Jackson Video Vanguard Award of the Year. And for whatever reason, Michael decided as part of the deal, Adam has to give it to me. But Adam's wife at the time was very pregnant and, you know, she was Dutch and didn't have anyone. We didn't really have infrastructure. If you're going to have a baby and I'm going to be in Los Angeles, we lived in New Jersey at the time. It's like, and that's going to be a problem. So like, no, send downtown Julie Brown or somebody else. I got to stay with my highly pregnant wife. We need you and you got to be in LA in 2 days. It has to be you. Otherwise this deal falls apart. So what they wound up doing is they flew my mother-in-law in on Concorde. So she took the supersonic plane when it still existed. And so she flew in and she stayed with my... Now, by the way, our daughter wasn't born until later. And as she was, you know, had to have C-section. So it never would have... It would have been horrible if I wasn't there, but luckily nothing happened. So I go to L.A. and go to MJJ Studios. And it was really interesting. So we walk in and right away, Howie Mandel is there and he's doing Bob. If you remember Bobby's World, he's doing Bobby's World voices for like maybe 20 kids who are in some kind of, you know, like school situation there, which Michael Jackson funded. I think so these were underprivileged kids. And so we get ready and Tom Freston's there. And because, of course, Freston needed to be in the mix somehow. I'm not sure why he got maybe Michael wanted him there, too, for legitimacy of how big this award was.
Yeah.
And we're ready to go. And there was already someone who was, you know, Windexing Michael's pants, you know, to make him nice and shiny. It was kind of weird. Like, you know, he had these pants on that had to be Windexed. And we're getting ready to go. And Michael's not a small guy. I'm 6'4". I had my hair. So I was probably 7 feet with the hair. And I'm ready to go. And he's, oh, no, hold on a second. And then he calls Bob over. Bob was a guy, kind of do anything guy. He whispers in his ear and Bob comes back with the apple crate so Michael could stand on it and be almost, you know, the same height as I was. It was very bizarre. It's like, okay, you want to be like that. That's fine. And then I gave him the award and he was very gracious and really nice. And he did the awards. He did the MTV awards and we did name the award after him until I think, J-Lo got it and I didn't hear the Michael Jackson words anymore. So it dropped away.
Wow. That's so interesting. Just in terms of meeting him, I would imagine you wouldn't be starstruck, or were you?
No, you know, I have been starstruck by other people, not Michael Jackson. Quincy Jones, I did an hour-long live radio interview and call-in with him, mm-hmm. and he came in, and we had a little table. It was a cool studio. They did it really well, in a kind of darkened studio, table in the middle, you know, two mics. We were across from each other. He brought in a bottle of Latour wine, which is like $1,500 a bottle. I didn't realize he was kind of an alcoholic at the time. I just thought he was being nice. He's like, come on, Adam. And he's pouring this wine. I didn't even know the value of the wine at the time. And I'm like, this is really good. And so we're kind of getting a little sloshed during this interview. And, I was so impressed because he produced Lena Horne, you know, all the way to Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He had such an array and he's cute. I mean, he's also kind of a gangster. He is a gangster. If you look at some of his history, he has some gangster stuff, but therefore he's very impressive guy. So more so from Quincy Jones than from Michael Jackson. And of course he produced Michael Jackson as well.
Yeah. Interesting. So when did you interview Paul McCartney, Adam?
Oh, that was very, this is when I just got to the Dutch radio station, so, or television, and I'm 19. And again, this is the public broadcasting system. So, well, yes. Yeah, so we like that these ragamuffin guys who have some airtime on the public system have put you on television, but you know, you really have to go through the official government interview course. I'm like, okay, what does that mean? Well, so every Thursday you'll come out, you go to the training center, and we will teach you how to interview people. Like, you know, like I just have a conversation with people in English, which is easy for me, and it kind of works out. No, no, but you have to go through this. Okay. So they would tell us how to interview and all stuff. I know there's nothing I didn't know. And then they would actually send us out for, you know, to do an assignment. Okay. Now you have to go interview people at the train station in this little village which is the Hollywood of the Netherlands. I'm like, okay. And I go out, interview people and edit it. You know, we still edited tapes with razor blades and, it's hard to imagine, but we had to do actual make a cut in the tape and then another cut and then put a little piece of tape over it. And, you know, so then the end of this is, you know, the third day, it's like, do you have any questions? Well, yeah, I'm interviewing Paul McCartney tomorrow in London. You got any questions for that? Because everything I did here didn't really pertain to talking to a guy like that. And they were just like, what are you doing? And that interview by itself was phenomenal. I mean, we went to MPL, McCartney Publishing Limited. The reason why we got the interview is because he had a video game coming out, which went along with his movie, not a huge success, Give My Regards to Broad Street. He also had an album. So it was a video game album and a movie. And, you know, it's kind of a movie about how Paul McCartney's master tapes are stolen and he has to go. It's almost like, you know, like a Monkees type music, almost comical. Yeah. Oh, the record's not going to come out because someone sold the master tapes. Okay. Who done it? You know, that's your video game. And so we go to MPL. You have to imagine McCartney Publishing Limited is kind of like the building is Scrooge McDuck like. You know, we have the door handles are dollar signs, but in this case, it's the MPL logo. and we get set up in this really big room with almost no furniture, just two chairs on a beautiful dark blue regal blue MPL rug, just, you know, like rich and shag and everything. These kind of golden, audacious looking chairs. And so we had our crew at the time. It was, you know, a crew was like five people. And you had to have a guy like, you know, crank up the video machine and everything. It was also reel to reel video. It was crazy. That was a portable machine. And now we just do it on our iPhone. It's better quality. And so Paul comes in and we sit down and we're drinking tea, you know, tea with milk and sugar. And something happened and I move and my tea goes all over the MPL rug. And I'm like, I'm horrified. I'm like, oh, so I get on my knees. Paul's on his knees. We're depping up the tea. Ding, the elevator doors are open. There's Linda McCartney. She's like, oh, let me help. And so I'm like, just let me realize what's happening right here. I'm here with Paul and Linda McCartney and we are picking up the tea from the MPL rug. And he was, of course, a lovely guy. You know, people love Paul McCartney and I can see why. It was a great interview and he was a great sport, obviously, for me to have, you know, partially ruined his carpet.
Surreal. That's Wonderful. So then getting back to MTV, I know you did a satellite interview with Janet Jackson when she wasn't there.
That was actually still in the Netherlands.
Oh, forgive me. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. In the Netherlands. When she wasn't there, you needed to send out an EPK. And for our audience, that's an electronic press kit. I've actually built them out myself. I'd love for you to talk about that experience.
Well, this just shows the dishonesty of the media, and television is inherently dishonest. I mean, what we have right here is pretty much as honest as you can get for video because there's no technical events. There's no edit. You might edit this at, you know, before you send it out. I don't know. But there's no zooms, even though it is zoomed in, you're zoomed in. You know, there's some technical things, but television in general is like, when we cut, we're outside. You just accept that we just jump from inside to outside and there's music and there's all kinds of things happening. It's all building a picture and a story in your mind. So you can do a lot of things and make it look like it's real. And Janet Jackson was, and I of course did interview Janet Jackson eventually somewhere down the line, but she couldn't come. And I don't know if she wasn't doing any press in-person press. I don't remember what video it was for. Maybe it was for Control. It could be. But she wasn't doing any press. And she sent out the EPK. And the way an EPK works is literally they have someone asking questions and they basically just give you the answers so that you can play these answers. You can edit that in. And what I did is I went into the edit and I had my questions. I timed my questions. And so we did like a satellite interview, like we're connecting to Janet Jackson live via satellite. That was the biggest lie. And you would even put in like some satellite, static, because of course it was not even digital then. Oh no, we're tuning the dish. Okay, everybody. Hey, Jan. And she'd go like, hi, good to see you. You know, which could have been Bob, whatever. And so I'd time my questions and then she would come in just like an answer. And sometimes even I delayed it a bit to give a little bit of overlap, to give that satellite, delay type, vibe, just to put the finishing touches on it. And of course everyone thought it was a live interview and I don't feel bad about it, but it does show you just how long people have been using television to create fake news, essentially.
Yeah.
That was fake. It was just one, I think I invented the first deep fake. There you go. I do recall one or two questions I asked, which was not the original question, but the answer fit in nicely with my question, So in essence, fake.
The first deep fake. One more thing to add to the Wikipedia profile, right?
Right. Yeah, please. Yes. I claim that.
Drawing on your time at MTV, I'm curious, is there anything any advice that you would give someone like me, for instance, when it comes to interviewing people?
Oh, you're actually doing, exactly what I would recommend. Just have a conversation with somebody. Know what they're about. Know their background. Know what you want to ask. You can ask any question you want at the right moment. That's all. I've asked the right question at the wrong moment. That does happen sometimes. It's a little different now because, back in the day, everyone didn't have a video camera. There was no Zoom. You weren't able, or there wasn't even requests for, five interviews a day or, it's like, it would be a big deal to have someone sit down and talk to them for 3 minutes. That would be, oh my goodness. And so just having a conversation and always have a little bit of a chit chat before with someone just to say, hi, how you doing? Here's what we're doing. You have any questions? And, just to get them to feel comfortable. But not really ask any of the pertinent questions, because if you tell them what you're going to ask, you're going to get dead answers. So, that's how when I asked Mick Jagger, and again, we were pretty young. He was young. I was young. It's like, have your kids heard this new album? He said, yeah. I said, what do they think of it? They think it's so you just get these beautiful answers that, that kind of stuff can only happen with spontaneity. And so, no matter what you're doing, don't do pre-interviews. This is why The Tonight Show is so dead compared to Joe Rogan.
Yep.
Joe Rogan doesn't ask you anything. He's just, you come in, you just start talking. He doesn't even know where you're going to, no one knows where you start the conversation. All of a sudden, just rolling. Jamie, rolling. Okay. Versus The Tonight Show, we'll have a segment producer, we'll have a line producer. You'll have the segment producer will ask you, okay, here's what Jimmy's going to ask you. Or here's what, what are the other guys? Here's what they're going to ask you. That's a great story. Make sure you bring that story up. And sometimes you'll hear the host say, now you had a story about something that happened in Burbank, right? And that'll be, oh yes, that's right. That's the story I agreed to with the producer that I would tell on your show. And that's dead. That's dead TV to me. And the ratings show that people don't care.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And that's been my evil scheme as well, is I like the spontaneity of just having a discussion. I think there's maybe been, I've interviewed now over 100 people all in, and I think maybe three I've done sort of pre-interviews with, and it was only when they requested because they'd be nervous or whatever. I much prefer the spontaneity, so I would agree with you. And I guess I'll keep it up.
Please do. You're doing great.
Thank you, Adam. I appreciate you saying that. I'd love to talk then about, before we leave MTV completely, start off, I suppose, easy. It'll be the easiest question of the day for you.
Okay.
Was presenting for MTV as glamorous a job as it looked? Because I know it wasn't.
No, it was hard work, and it was sometimes very mundane and boring. What it gave was me an opportunity to do my radio show the way I wanted it. I traveled around I did amazing things in my television career. I've done documentaries in Australia, Thailand. I've skied almost every great skiing mountain there is in the United States, thanks to the Pro Mogul Tour. No one else can. MTV, another deal they cut, and no one else could ski. So they sent me. I've done fantastic things. I've driven Indy cars on the track. You know, all the stuff you get to do was, of course, exhilarating, fantastic. The perks of being well known and moving to the front of the line is lots of fun. But the work itself, hard work. And I did my best for it because I wanted to come across as knowledgeable research. That's why I got to do a lot of interviews, particularly on Headbangers Ball. And I knew the music and I understood the music, but in the music, not just the songs and the album, but what they were doing musically. I'd studied a lot of just studio work and how albums are made. I could do everyone's job at a television studio, which I think gave me the opportunity to get the best product out of the crew, because the crew is like, ugh, it's that guy again. You know, if I come in unprepared, I know what the hell I'm doing, and I know how everyone else's job works. I can say, hey, Celeste, here's an idea. Why don't we, if you pull a close up here, and then maybe Mitch, director, if we switch that, that might actually make it cool. And then you have a standing. You know, if you come in, you're prepared, you can be part of the team. And otherwise, you're just an a-hole talent. And I never wanted to be that. So that was what I really enjoyed doing. And that's why I never fell into any trappings of real showbiz success, parties, drugs. I was much more interested in doing great work.
Mm, that's wonderful.
That's why I look like I'm so young and healthy, even though I'm 87.
You just turned 37, I think, right?
No. Exactly.
It's funny that you mentioned Joe Rogan before I did. I was planning on bringing him in. I know you told him, I guess it was January of this year, when you were interviewed, you told him that although you were at MTV for 7 years, you never had a good relationship with them, right?
No, correct. Yeah. Correct. And that was because, although I'm a great team player in production, I'm going to speak my mind. And I didn't realize how all those deals were put together and how important it was to not be critical of anything anyone did of any importance. So like day three, I'm there and they had me up in the office to do an interview with TV Guide, which at the time, TV Guide, that was the biggest magazine in America. I mean, everyone had TV Guide. And it was a very short, you know, these interviews are always very short, but I was just talking like, oh, you met Madonna, you interviewed Madonna. Yeah, I did. What was she like? Well, she's not really nice. She's kind of bitchy. And, you know, and they were shocked, I tell you, that I said that about Madonna. I hope she'll still do the MTV Awards. And of course, Madonna would still do the MTV Awards, even if she had to, you know, knock down the door herself. So, you know, but yeah, so they didn't like me from day one. I was definitely a problem. Because I would, you know, just say stuff that I thought was fun or accurate. And ultimately they had control. It was like, no, we're going to burn that, you know, which means we're going to erase that, go back, do it over. And you have to leave that part out. So there was a lot of freedom of speech issues, but hey, it's their studio, their channel, their dime. They get to determine that. And I think that ultimately I had a lot of freedom in the Netherlands, certainly on the radio. We did a lot of stuff that was iffy. And so I came from that place, funny enough. You know, I came from this socialist country to the land of freedom of speech. And that's the first thing I noticed is, oh, my freedom of speech is kind of curtailed here on the airwaves. And that, I'm sure, has always been behind the necessity to be a pirate radio broadcaster or, you know, podcasting, which, of course, you can pretty much do anything you want.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One other quote I had for you, because don't we all love being quoted out of context? You told Joe Rogan that stars don't exist on MTV, and I'd love to know what you meant by that.
Well, they could not exist. You could not. They did not want you to be bigger than the channel. The channel was the star. The big M, the little TV logo, MTV was the star. No one else could grow above it. Really, not even the music stars themselves. That was just a cultural. It was a cultural given inside the organization. That's just how it worked. So, you know, they would determine what you look like. They would determine, you know, what the shot is. They determine all of this stuff. And so, you know, they would say, well, we're sick of Curry's hair. Tell him to go cut it. And I'd be like, no. And like, well, we're going to have to fire you then. Okay. And they wouldn't, or they would. They did five or six times, maybe seven times. Mm-hmm. And then they'd hire me back. It would, you know, it's so easy to get fired and then get rehired within a day. I mean, you see it all the time on network TV. All these things just happen. Or like you take a time out for like Whoopi Goldberg, you know, oops, said something wrong, go away, come back. But you really have no say. And so Whereas, and it was understandable. There were also a lot of radio people who were running MTV in the beginning. And at radio stations, is very much the program director, the music director, they're the stars of the station, general manager as well. You're just a disc jockey. You read the, you just read what's on the liner card. You intro the songs. You do the promotion. Okay. Just so you know that we're going to treat you like, don't you dare grow any bigger than your britches are. That's just a management style. It's a very old school. In fact, it's exactly what James O'Keefe is being of Project Veritas is being accused of having that management style, which is you do this right or you're fired. I mean, I've heard that, and not just at MTV. I've heard it throughout my media career. It's typical. It's just typical. And it's in fashion photography. It's in print. It's in every mainstream media organization has had or may still have a version of that, where it's just like, you get this done this way, well, you're fired, mister.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's just what it was. And of course, now today, you know, who's going to fire you if it's your own show, which is
right.
Part of what I love the most.
Yeah. There's a point of contact here, Adam, because the one through line that I'm sort of noticing since we started talking is this primacy of freedom of speech. There's mm-hmm. nothing more important. And I agree. I'm an absolutist myself. I'm a writer and a podcaster, and we make our living basically on the idea that we can say what we want in the way that we want. Would you consider freedom of speech to be your great cause at the moment, the thing that you would go to the stake for, so to speak?
I wouldn't, even though I agree that I'm an absolutist, I would not say that's what I'm doing.
Mm.
To me, it's like I can't even take into account anyone who doesn't understand free speech. So I don't even want to deal with that. What I want to do is make sure that we have the actual mechanisms to be doing it. So if you look at podcastindex.org, which is literally the authority as it comes to all podcasts, you know, you cannot get deplatformed from that. It doesn't cost anything to be on it. It doesn't cost anything for a developer to create apps or services against it, with purely donation-based, or as we say, value for value.
Mm-hmm.
It is literally, well, we started off by saying this is to protect free speech. We dialed that back because that was so politically charged by saying that. And it's hard to talk about, you know, we are pro First Amendment. It just is meaningless. But to say we're here to protect, defend, and extend podcasting, people understand that. So that to me is important. And I think because I come from phony baloney media my entire life, although for the past 15 years I've been podcasting, I want that to stay around. That's my job. We have everyone has a job in this world. And after doing a lot of things, my job is to show people, what I think is a way to podcast, show a way to make money with it, which does not involve advertising or other, to make your life censorship resistant, and really to protect that. And that I'll protect with the Second Amendment. You know, you do not mess with podcastindex.org or with a value for value. This, I'll go to the mat for those two things that I have within my grasp. I can shepherd that so that, you know, you will have a place to podcast far into the future, far beyond my lifetime. That's my ultimate goal. And does that coincide with freedom of speech? Yeah, you bet.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Well, I think it's high time we get into your podfather status.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, you basically, and I know we talked before I hit record here, I know it isn't quite this simple, but you effectively invented the podcast, the medium that you and I are talking on right now involved you a great deal. Take as much time as you need to on this, Adam, but I'd really love to hear about how that all came to fruition for you.
I'll tell you the genesis, and it starts around 2000. And I'll start with Dave Weiner, who around that time was working on this new format called XML and a version of it, RSS, which stood initially for really simple syndication. And he was creating blogging, and he is undisputedly the first person to create the software to create a blog and the other side, which is an aggregator. Now, many people won't remember this because it went away a long time ago, but for a while there, blogs were super hot. Everyone had a blog and you had an RSS feed, and people could subscribe to that RSS feed in a news reader, which would either be a standalone piece of software. There were actually, the Mac had a couple of good ones, or at a certain point, Google had Google Reader. and everybody had Google Reader, and you could just subscribe to blogs. So when there was a new blog post, boom, it popped up. You could, you know, put them in collections. You could manage it. It was basically a feed very analogous to your Facebook feed, your Instagram feed, your TikTok feed, your Twitter feed. And, but they were usually like a subject and a little, excerpt of a longer blog post. Or later we got microblogging, where people just posting little things. And that, of course, became what Twitter is today. But it was decentralized. You didn't need to sign up to a Silicon Valley company. But, you know, freedom always requires an extra step that people aren't usually, they like ease of use. So instead of getting some software and figuring it out, they just let the big old Google show them how to do it. And eventually Google just shut that down because, like, hey, we can't make money off of this. This is no good. And then they started, what was that? The Google Plus, I think is what it was called. And you had your friends and your circles and failed.
Oh, yeah, it was Google Plus.
Google yep. Plus, yeah. That's what they shut that down to launch some other product, which aborted. So Dave Weiner was doing that early on. And he had the software called Radio Userland, which that already struck a chord with me. It's like, oh, radio, I kind of get it. So you would broadcast your microblog, and you could also receive it on the same software. So it was a news reader. At the time, I'd moved my family back. I sold my company. I thought I was going to retire, semi-retired. Now, of course, I immediately started doing other spending my money on dumb stuff, like flying helicopters, you name it. But we had cable modems that just launched in the Netherlands. So it was very, very densely cabled country. And the cable modem was not that it was really fast, but it had a revolutionary thing. You didn't need to dial in anymore. So you didn't have to, you know, get your modem, unplug your telephone, plug in a modem, wait for that connection to happen, that handshake. And, you know, of course, you couldn't really, if you had call waiting, that was horrible because someone would call you, the connection would break. Right. You know, maybe you use the fax line and someone tried to send you. It was horrible. So now your computer could be on all the time. And just like email, there's this magic that happens when something is happening on the internet, but you don't know it until it has been downloaded and you get an alert on your computer. So the big aha moment was, wait, someone can send me an email with an attachment, like, and, you know, 10 megabytes at the time could take 45 minutes to download. I mean, it could take quite a while. But you wouldn't know that because the email software would just be sitting there, and then not until it had downloaded, they go, bling, they got this new email. Even that was unthinkable. 10 megabytes was too much. But just for the idea, 1 megabyte in 1996 or so would take an hour. 1 megabyte would take an hour to download on a dial-up line. So this was not much faster, but it was, at least it was always on computing. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool? Because, you know, the experience of websites was, oh, here's a video. You click on it, it would download for 10 minutes. Just watch that download progress bar. Then you'd click it, open it up. It would open in some player. And you get, like, you know, 15 seconds of a little postage size stamp video. It was a bad experience. Certainly no click, and I'm delighted. So the idea was, why not, if your computer's doing, it has to do stuff for you anyway, don't just let it sit idle. But let's say it wants to subscribe to something and it wants to get, you know, whatever the latest item is from that, but it has a file attached to it. It would download the file, then tell me it's there. I wouldn't be hurt by the wait because I didn't know about the wait. And it doesn't matter that it was published 15 minutes ago or 15 hours ago, as long as I get it and I get the alert and I click and I have an immediate experience. And I thought this would be great to add that to Dave Weiner's RSS software as an attachment. Basically, like, can we, with a blog post, can we put an attachment to it? And, you know, and then we can do video that way. That was my initial thinking. And I flew to New York to convince him of this. And it took me 2 days. And he finally said, yeah, okay, I see. I think I understand what you're doing. And so he built that in. And for, this is 2000. So for several years, you know, I would wake up in the morning and there would be like a Grateful Dead video, because Dave was really into Grateful Dead. You know, I could watch a whole video that was there, was just ready to go. I knew it was from Dave. It had a little note attached to it. I was only subscribed to his feed. No one else was using this. And then I saw my first iPod. And this, my immediate thought was, and this is the first one, which was the big kind of white with a big dial on the front. And it had really cool rounded edges. And it was like a soft, smooth feel to it. Had this little cool LCD display and you could see the tracks. And I didn't think Walkman, which I had actively been, you know, I had a Walkman as a kid. I didn't think digital jukebox. I thought radio receiver. This is just like the solid-state Sony AM transistor radio my grandmother gave me, which came in a handsome leatherette carrying case, was about the same size. And I was like, what if, and the way that worked in the early days is your computer, you had, if you want to put new music on your iPod, you had to sync it to your Mac, basically, before it was even on Windows. So what if the same program that Dave and I were using, what if I build that in AppleScript, which, believe me, I'm no programmer. So it would just download one feed, which would be like a show that I put together with just with audio files, because I can do radio stuff. And then when it comes in, it'll automatically sync it to the iPod. You pick up the iPod, you've got your radio show on the go. And it doesn't matter when I created. So that was the concept of a subscription to a show. We didn't have a name for it. It, you know, show. And when I had this working front to back, and I had some help from Kevin Marks, who is now, I think, at Google, he helped me with the AppleScript, and another guy named Marcus, you know, because again, I'm not a programmer. But then I was like, okay, I'm going to put this thing out there. Here's the source code to what I've built. We need to make this work. We need applications for all kinds of players. We had, you know, other MP3 players. We need it for Windows. There were no phones. You know, there was I think the Zune hadn't even come out from Microsoft. And so I said, and what I'll do is I'll create a show, a feed with a new episode every day, so we have something to test against. And what I did is I just talked about the developers who showed up. We didn't have GitHub or any of this. You know, we didn't have chat rooms. We had email and like a forum. That was basically it. So it was, the communication was kind of cool. I would say, oh, it looks like Andrew over here with iPodder X, and these guys with iPod, they called it iPodder because, you know, iPod, podding something. We didn't know what it was. And we just talk about I would just talk about what they were doing. Did a little bit of a show with Dave Weiner as well called Trade Secrets. But that was hard to maintain with time frames and even the equipment of the day. You know, it was, I was trying to do everything on my little Mac, because I could build a whole radio studio. I know how to do that, but I wanted everything to be able to be done by everybody. So I was trying to figure out the best way to record a show on your Macintosh at the time, even with adding some music and, you know, like trying to emulate a real professional radio studio. Very, very challenging at the time. And that just took off. And then a guy came in, Danny Gregoire, and he said, oh, I'm calling this podcasting. That's been disputed. Ben Hammersley says that he invented the word. He did certainly invent that word and use it in a context before, you know, months before we were even podcasting. So it was kind of a future tell for him, but I think Danny Gregoire is the one who really came up with it. Doesn't really matter. It stuck, you know, for good or for bad. And that's when, you know, interviews just started happening for me with the NPR, BBC. Since I was living in the Netherlands, I've made it much easier to talk with the BBC. And it just went really, really fast. And so now I was certainly the one out there promoting it a lot at the time. Now, there's no patents or anything on this. Neither Dave Weiner or I have ever been interested in this. So there's no money on it. The whole idea was to have a way for anybody to broadcast whatever they want without any requirement from any other company. I mean, you can literally set up your own server on your modem at home if you want. Mm-hmm. And you should be able to do this. And the RSS format itself is so simple that you can look at it and you can read it as a human being and kind of understand what's going on with it. You don't need to have, again, some fancy company making this feed for you. You could write it yourself. And a lot of people did in the early days. You could write it yourself if you wanted to. And that was the genesis of podcasting until Steve Jobs called me. Mm-hmm. And said, actually, it was ADQ. And he said, can you meet with Steve next Thursday, whatever, in San Diego? I said, let me check Eddie. Very, very busy man. So, of course, I did. And that was, that rivaled Quincy Jones in Starstruck, because Steve Jobs, very impressive guy, particularly when he wants something from you. And then we talked for an hour, and it was really nice. And he was very complimentary, and he was very on our side, you know, like, yeah, you know, the mainstream media, not really like that, not those same words. But it's like, this is so great alternative. This is, anyone can do this. And he said, you know, can I put it into iTunes and the iPod? Is that okay? It's like, you want my blessing for this?
Wow.
Yeah. I said, no, I don't think he needed it. I don't think he just felt it would be a good idea to ask me. And that was very flattering. And so he presented it, you know, literally the same day. He had all good to go. He had the demo. He had my voice, and there's a great video of it. It's hilarious. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly what I was going to say. I mean, all of that was, I'm sure he was a show guy from beginning to end. And it was a great launch. I had given them the directory that we had built, which was about 3,000-4,000 podcasts at the time. And of course, disappointingly, when it launched, it was all NPR, you know, like big, you know, radio stations who were on the front page. And, you know, and like, yeah, there was a Daily Source Code, kind of like, well, we'll put this guy over here for a while just so, you know, they rotate that with the Dawn and Drew show or whatever the alternative stuff. The people who had really built the medium immediately got relegated to page two, you know, and that was a little disappointing, but also understandable. And of course, now we see that it's exactly the opposite. You know, if you go look at iTunes, you're going to see that it's a whole bunch of other shows that are popular now, and the NPRs and BBCs are still important, but they're not top ranking the way they used to be.
No, not at all. I've been very heartened by that. I like the fact that the power's kind of gone to the people in terms of the information that we're putting out there. One question I really wanted to ask you, Adam, was, did you have any inkling that podcasting would become the standard? Like it would be, you know, you and I have this conversation now, the Joe Rogans and the, you know, the Jordan Harbingers of the world basically taking over the media. Did you know it'd be so popular?
I was never thinking of it, but here's what I've observed. It has shown that if popularity is no longer important. This is what I like so much about what's happened with media and certainly through podcasting. It works against you to be part of a network. The network is the internet. You don't need YouTube, Spotify, Apple. You know, you don't need any of those. You don't need Google. You don't need Amazon. Conversely, you don't need to be number one to reach your audience. So there's no artificial scarcity. There's no, oh, you can only hear this podcast on Saturdays from noon to three. So you can build your own schedule. You can support whatever you want to. You can listen to whatever you want to. And I have seen so many properties, so many calm shows, whatever you want to call them, that are sustaining because of their own audience. Whether they are number one on iTunes doesn't matter, because, you know, you don't hear people saying, yeah, I listen to Joe Rogan because there's really nothing else on at that time, or there's no alternative. No, there's lots of alternatives. You listen to Joe Rogan because you like Joe Rogan, and you listen to No Agenda because you like No Agenda. You could listen to anything you want, and when you don't like it, there's 20 alternatives. So as long as you can find a way to get the value out of the production that you're doing, which doesn't have to be money, it can be a whole bunch, it can be feedback, it can be a business, it can be you know, your books or something else you do. I mean, it can be all kinds of stuff, or literally, you know, people have figured out advertising. I think that's advertising always equals censorship. So I think it's kind of adverse and, in fact, the opposite of what really works on podcasting. But, you know, people always try to shoehorn the old model into the new model. And that model is very much built on how many people, how many bodies, how many warm human bodies. Well, so what if I had 100 people who are the smartest people in the world, I could make no money on advertising on that show. Even if I said, yeah, but they're the smartest people in the world. Yeah, no, we have to have 100,000. Otherwise, you're not going to make any advertising money. Now, for someone who wants to influence these 100 people, that might be worth something to them. So that's where you got, you know, the host reads and the, like, I endorse this product. But I think it's much more exciting to ask people, well, what was this worth to you? And if that was worth, if it was worth anything, send me that. Because that's what I learned 15 years ago, is when you say, hey, send me whatever you thought this show was worth. Actually, us, because John C. DeWarrick and myself. Yeah, a lot of people sent us $5 a month, but we also got lots of people sending 50 and several sending 500. Like, wow. Now, does that mean that they're rich? Maybe to them, $500 is a spit in the bucket. They valued it just a little bit. And maybe the person who sends five really, really can't spare that, but did it anyway because of the amount of value they got. Now we have a system. Now we got something that's really important for both sides, and we can build from there. That's what podcasting has taught me, is that the idea of You have to be the most popular, have the most listeners is not important. It's great, but it's not important. You can have a great community, congregation, cult, whatever you want to be with just yourself and them. And you can organize everything you want around that. And you should be able to sustain that. If not, it's not the outstanding product you thought it was.
Yeah. Excellent. That's probably why I'm doing well. I've never been popular.
you could give Jonah Hill a run for his money, brother. I've seen you. Yeah, he did that interview movie, you know, with his therapist.
That's true. That's hilarious. I don't think we've covered it yet. We've kind of gleaned at it, and I'll love to ask you directly, Adam. What is the No Agenda podcast, and what made you start it?
The No Agenda podcast started. I foolishly thought after the Steve Jobs encounter, he actually hooked us up with the venture capital investors in San Francisco, that we could build a network of podcasts and we could bring in advertisers and the revenue would be shared and it would all work and there would be their own person, but still we'd provide centralized services. And I learned you cannot monetize the network. It doesn't work for a whole host of reasons. This is why Spotify is not going to be able to do it. And I fundamentally don't believe in networks. But what I did enjoy is I'd met this guy, John C. Dvorak. He's a little bit older than I am, but he's a very famous columnist, a bit snarky. And I wound up hiring him at Pod Show to do a daily tech show. He's a technology columnist and writer. And since I was going back and forth between London, where I was living at the time, and San Francisco, you know, we'd see each other every couple of weeks, and I'd be there for a couple of weeks, and we'd go out to lunch, and we'd chat, and we'd catch up on stuff. And I really enjoyed that when I was back in London. So we would be on Skype, early versions of Skype, talking about the difference in how the media was portraying world events in London and in Europe versus in the United States. And we would literally look at newspapers. And what are you reading? I'm reading this. And then these would be half-hour Skype conversations. And then said, you know, why don't we just record this? Now we'll turn it into a podcast. And it'll be completely, we have no agenda, so we'll just call it No Agenda. And there'll be no jingles, there'll be no nothing, just, you know, no ads, just you and me talking. And that caught on really quickly. And what happened was it caught on so quickly that we were like, you know, this is starting to turn into some work. And you need to pay us because it's too much work for us to do this without getting some value back. And we started by saying, you know, $3 a month or whatever. And of course, we had that set up. You could donate $3 a month with predictable results. We got the $3 a month from 100 people. That wasn't going to feed us. And then we just said, you know, that's not working. Just send us whatever you think it's worth. And we built this pitch over time called Value for Value. So we give you value with the show, whatever you think it's worth. If it's not enough to give us anything, then why are you even bothering? Then, you know, there's something wrong with you. We expanded that later to time, talent, and treasure. So you can send value back with your time by creating album art for us, with your talent, maybe building a website. We've never built a website ourselves, all built by other people. There's hundreds of No Agenda websites and sub websites and all kinds of stuff. So we just said, go for it, whatever you think it's worth. And turns out, as I said earlier, that, you know, people would send up to $500 a show. And what we did immediately is we would read in the donation segment every donation that came in, a short little note, the amount. So you can track exactly how much money is coming in. There's no secret. We've done that for 1,533 episodes. You can see exactly how much money people are sending us, which also became a bit aspirational. And then, you know, then we built in levels. Like if you've given $1,000, doesn't matter, in one go, we're over 2 years or 10 years, we'll make you a knight. Or a dame with a No Agenda roundtable, and we have a little ceremony for you. And now, you know, people have meetups. They organize their own meetups around the world. NoAgendaMeetups.com. Didn't build the website. Don't organize it. That's all producer driven. They have a community. You know, community is important. So if I do anything myself, is I know how to stimulate a community and how to build that. But it's just grown now to 3 hours per show, lots of jingles and fun and mayhem, but also just two guys who deconstruct media. We know how phony it is. We know how the sausage is made, as you and I have just discussed. And so we can, and print as well. And, you know, not John knows a lot about that. We got stories. We have, you know, history in these areas. So we can laugh and say, this is such bull crap. Look, then here's why, because we've seen this done, or this exact thing happened 12 years ago, you know, and we have long memories. So that's kind of, it's not, we're both conservative, more conservative than anything, but we have a liberal view. We're anti-war. We're very anti-war. And that's, you know, just, we're anti-war. Always been that. So, you know, when we looked at Obama, we said he's droning people every single day. He's not anti-war. You know, everyone's at war. The only one we didn't have war, interesting, was Trump, interestingly enough. But, you know, now we have a war, stupid war, and we know why. And now we have an audience that's so big that we have boots on the ground. Everybody's an expert at something. So we have lots of people in military, in medical. We have people, politicians, people who work in television studios, people everywhere. And they're like, you know, most of them want to be anonymous, but they have standing. They know what's going on in their field. And if we screw it up, or if we're saying, hey, who knows anything about this, they'll write us. And we know how to keep them confidential. And so we have boots on the ground reports. So like when COVID came, we had a lot of boots on the ground, a lot of, you know, professionals who could really give us an alternative to what the media was telling us.
Wow. That's extraordinary, Adam. Thank you for sharing that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Just a couple questions left, Adam, and then we're all set. I really appreciate you taking the time, by the way.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks, John. You
know, it's always great to be the guy who writes the history.
Yeah, see? Absolutely.
And, you know, in 50 years, someone will dig this interview up and say, oh, that's the history of podcasting. Always wanted to know. Okay.
How we transmit history is through stories. That's why I have this podcast. That's why I love doing it.
Exactly right.
Yeah. You know, you've been interviewed many times, you know, Joe Rogan, Mike Malice, Guy Kawasaki, just to name a few. I've listened to all those in preparation for this. Has there been a question that hasn't been asked of you that you wish someone would ask?
Well, that by itself is a question that I don't think anyone has asked me. And, you know, I think that depending on where you are in your life, you often want to say something and you wish, if someone would only ask me this, then I'd tell them what I really think. But I don't have that because twice a week, you know, I spout exactly what I think and exactly how I feel. You said something really important, though, that I actually need to take note of. You say the way we pass on history is through stories. That's a really good observation. Of course, it's true, but it's also a good thing to say and to remind people of. And I think as long as I can tell a story in an interview, it doesn't matter what the question is. And if I've learned anything over time, it's that I have a story for almost everything. Some of my wife would say, oh, of course, he's got a story about that. No one has ever asked, or, you know, there's never been something I wish people would ask me. But it's important to know that when you want that, it's really because you want to tell a story. And it's whether it's your side of a story or your story to tell. I think that's really important that good stories and good storytelling is really what we need. A lot more of that, honestly. We need some good storytelling in the world.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's not much more to say. I completely agree. It's brilliant. Adam Curry, how can people find out about you, sir?
Well, if you're on Mastodon, which is kind of the main social network, we have noagendasocial.com, which we set up, 2016 or 2017, very early, at least for Mastodon. The new network has been around for a while. So I'm adam@noagendasocial.com. That's the best way to find. You know, I post there. I do also post on Twitter. If I do post, or if I post a show or something, it's @AdamCurry. And that's a good way. If you just want to say hi, you can always hit me there. I use it as an inbox, basically, public inbox. And then if you want to try out, you know, some of the stuff we've been working on, if you go to podcastapps.com, you can see not just what Adam Curry's been doing and what I'm working on, but what quite a large group of mainly young people has been putting together, the new podcast experiences, podcast hosts by themselves are all kind of outlaws, you know, serving part of this community. And that's really that's the best way to follow what I'm doing or to find me. But yeah, anyone can shoot me. You can also email me adam@curry.com. It's real easy to remember, and, you know, hit me up with anything. I read all my email. You know, it's a task, but that I look forward to it every day.
Excellent. Adam, I'm really glad that you answered my email, man. This was a pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time for me.
No, Joshua, my pleasure. And I look forward to this. And I'm glad that you're doing it. Thank you for being a historian, a modern day historian. That's really important.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate that. I will let you go. I hope you take care and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again, Adam. This was a real pleasure.
My pleasure, man. No problem.
All right. Take care, man.
Okay.
Bye. Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.